Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Now entering the ninth year of Connect the Dots radio program just this month, I'm a longstanding journalist of food, health, and the environment, also looking at science, public policy, activism, advocacy, and all of the things in our interconnected total health environment, as I call it, that affect our personal well-being, the well-being of our families, our community, our society, and impact the ecological balance on planet Earth. So this is what we discuss every week on this program and connect the dots between, you know, our individual lives and, you know, what we kind of perceive in our immediate frame is going on with the world and what's going on in a larger systemic sense. That's what we discuss every week on the show with authors, experts, scientists, gardeners, filmmakers, poets, activists, advocates, authors, and a whole host of other people every week on Connect the Dots. And please do check out our archives as well, because a lot of really fascinating and terrific people have participated in these wonderful hour-long conversations that we have every week and air on Wednesday. Today we're returning to a theme that basically we've been developing for the last year or so, which is the role of food and food agriculture, organics, restorative agriculture, regenerative agriculture, sort of new terms for some of us, as a lens for both supporting life on Earth and for fixing and restoring, you know, what is harmful and broken, that human industry and systems and social policy have kind of created as adverse sort of elements in the greater world to which we belong. So I'm delighted to welcome on the show today Mark Cohn. He has a terrific background, and we'll be discussing a kind of big picture and small detailed picture in the area of regenerative agriculture and permaculture. Mark has a background in wildlife biology, ecology, ethnobotany, permaculture, cooperative land use, and renewable energy. He has been an organic inspector with the organic program of the FDA for 26 years. Lives in southern Ohio at Far Valley Farm, a 30-year-old intentional community he helped to co-found. Mark personally has lived off the grid for 37 years. He grows a wide range of crops, seeds, honey, mushrooms, and medicinals. He founded the Belize Agroforestry Research Center, a permaculture research and teaching facility based in southern Belize. And he has spent 25 winters in Central America practicing and teaching tropical permaculture. We are, you know, fortunate that Mark is in the U.S. right now and speaking to us on the show today, braving the rather intense winter weather, cold weather that we've been experiencing throughout the country and especially in the Northeast where I am speaking from. So welcome so much, Mark Cohn, to Connect the Dots.
Thank you, Allison, and thank you for doing this show. It seems very on point and important. So, yes, it is a, you know, a week ago we had 10 below zero here, and today it's 62 degrees, so it's bouncing around, which we can expect, I think, from what we know about what's happening in our atmosphere and our management of that.
Yes. So, I mean, it's been rather severe, and I personally, given, you know, the kind of adversity that journalism has been under nowadays, which has been my career for the last several decades, you know, I'm thinking of going into making heavy woolen outer clothing pants for people as much as career. You know, so people can layer and brave the weather that, you know, we are participating in actively or passively as we sort of go along with the systems that have been laid down in our culture. And, you know, as someone who kind of spends more than half my time in a rural environment and also a significant portion of time in an urban environment, I, having encountered your work at the recent BioNutrient Food Foundation Association conference, I thought it would be really, really helpful to our listeners, most of whom are, we're all sort of in living within a civilization that is kind of going along in a certain way that we take for granted, that, you know, it's the only way to run things, or it's too big to change, or it's eternally going to be there, or maybe it'll break down, but we don't know what that will look like and how to respond or prepare for it, which is, you know, the stance that I'm in and many other people are in, just living within the given civilization. And what I was really fascinated by in hearing you speak at the conference and, you know, what I hope we'll talk about today is, you know, what is the reality if we peel back what we're doing as a civilization and look at its impacts? What is the reality? Where are we headed? And how can we better plan for and, you know, participate in constructive shifts to mitigate some of where we're headed? And I think, you know, so let's begin. And what am I, for example, and other people who are just kind of living within the civilization, assuming will be in continuity and taking for granted, kind of the ongoing every day as it always was kind of thing. What is going to be shifting and changing, and what is our participation in creating shifts that, you know, could leave us in a very bad place, as well as obviously is currently harming both people and many other species? You know, what are we not seeing when we live in that civilized frame that's actually going on?
Well, most of the biological world, I guess I would say, there's a lot, you just said a lot of things. I would say from my experience that the primary thing that we can't see is the hidden subsidies in our conditioned thinking coming out of an age of petroleum products and cheap labor from around the world, slavery, et cetera, has really blocked our ability to see what happens in a much more lean economic, ecological system. And it really wasn't for me until I spent time out of the country in remote locations in tropical forests where there was really no subsidies in that system to lean on, and a lot of clarity basically comes in at that point. I think some of the overarching elements that we need to look at, because I'm not going to spend much time talking about what's wrong. I think that all you need to do is flip on the news and get a pretty good grip on that, and that the implications of where we're headed is not in a very good direction. So I'd like to take our time and look at the leverage points of where we can really reverse that. Now, my background was originally in wildlife biology, and the revelation that I had, so to speak, was really around the power of understanding habitat of any given species or groups of species, and how that habitat is not a fixed static thing, but it can be moved in a direction of supporting more life and higher quality life, or reduced and to be able to support less and less. And that's the trajectory we've been on. And I think the simple way to think about it is basically in terms of natural capital. We have an economic system that is pretty close to fully divorced from the basis from which it arises, which is ecological or a natural system of nutrient flow and driven from photosynthesis and food chains and so forth. And I think that we're out of phase with that at the simplest level, and we have a tremendous opportunity to get back into phase. I think one of the disempowering things that most people experience is that it is all so big, and how do you turn this large Titanic of a system around? Even though most people know that it's really not tracking anywhere than into an iceberg, ultimately. And I think that the empowering part happens more at the ground level. I would call maybe more home economics, where the things that we can do in our own environments begin to reverse those relationships, because at the end of the day, we're really talking about relationships. I got into agriculture because of a couple things. One was that in my studies of wildlife biology and ecology, that agriculture was really one of the biggest problems, the existential threat, so to speak. And so I got into that, and it's, you know, almost 40 years later, I'm still pretty embedded in it. However, I'm taking boundaries down between how we normally think about agriculture, and I'm taking boundaries down between, say, forestry and agriculture, or eventually between medicine and food, as we begin to understand a lot of the connective concepts through soils, mineral balancing, biology in soils, and in landscapes in general, we really start to get toward more of an integrated, holistic relationship. And it gets very interesting and hopeful, especially from the ground up. The part that becomes difficult is that the answers that we can get into about most of our biggest problems of the day require a lot of people to practice to sail their portion of the watershed that they're in, I guess is how I might put it, because all of these landscapes are knitted together in a mosaic pattern that is all interconnected. And so I think that another overarching principle is that we have too many consumers and not enough producers. And I think, you know, if you look at production from a biological sense of how natural systems generate abundance and create these food chains, we can learn a lot about how to increase the not only production. I think that's been overdone through commodification, but particularly when something is produced in a way that is enhancing that environment as opposed to undermining it. And I guess I would reference the idea of principle and interest in a biological account. In other words, when you harvest something or remove something to provide our needs, which we need to do one way or the other, there's a way of doing that where you're not drawing down the principle, you're not eroding the soil or polluting the water or eliminating pollinators or thousands of different organisms in the soil that provide minerals through biological pathways rather than feeding them with chemicals and such. So I've been looking more and more at what the land can do long-term and how to achieve the needs that people have. And I think there are some very fascinating options for us to look at if we can get past sort of a single-function thinking. Unfortunately, we come right up against the conditioning of modern Western civilization when you go from a single function to a model that's a lot more like a natural ecosystem, where it's almost a little bit more like hunting and gathering when you get to a healthier system. And I guess what I would call that not just healthy but resilient, that became something very clear to me that was measurable and real, is the relative resilience of an organism or an ecosystem, and what is that based on? And that takes us back.
I just want to ask you something.
Yeah.
Can you define single function? Because I think that's really important, because it is, you know, I think I know what you mean. I'm not sure everybody will without some further definition. Because this is really critical to how we approach things. And, you know, perhaps an example would help. I mean, I was having an exchange with somebody on Facebook the other day. And this guy said to me, you know, they were kind of taking down an integrative physician. He's not a perfect individual. He has some problems. Cited a big problem with him as, oh, he recommends country tea, and, you know, that could change something that's another toxin. Is that what you mean by single function?
I think I can talk about that a little bit. The connection isn't very good here. I think I got your drift, though. Yes. So, for example, I think, you know, forestry is often seen as largely board feet of lumber. And if you're harvesting mm-hmm. board lumber, you can easily go across that boundary where you're taking your principle. Now, if you're, on the other hand, looking at the wide range of potential medicinal plants and mushrooms and wild meat and building materials and so forth, done in a way that is deriving. And I'd like to talk about how there's an opportunity of harvesting some of the biomass to achieve electricity and space heat. And wind up with something very long-term and valuable called biochar. it's a very big difference when you're thinking of managing a forest for just board feet of lumber and maybe 30 or 40 different types of products that are all coming in a more, I don't usually use the word sustainable, but in a more sustainable or resilient way. And so another example would be, you know, corn and soybeans, when you could have hundreds of species, and actually the preceding ecosystems, the prairies and all of the natural systems that were there before the corn and soybeans, were incredibly more diverse. And so when I say single function, I'm actually talking about homogeneity in general, in our thinking and in our landscapes. And we can begin to measure some of this by looking, say, within species, like, are you growing a single species, and is that species diverse within itself? Intraspecies diversity, in other words, anybody that's heard about the potato famine should know that, you know, selecting two varieties out of 4,000 to 8,000 varieties of potatoes from the Andes region, Central America, South America, wound up with a very uniform genetic population of potatoes, which predictably would crash. If we look at our crops the same way today, we are dangerously narrowing our genetic base. So you have diversity within the species, and you have the total diversity of species in a landscape. I would also say in our gut microbiome, in our social structures of having a diversity of age groups and cultures and such. And so diversity is something that emerges every time in an overview analysis of whether a system is resilient or not. So I think what you're asking about single functions that I'm referring to is, what is our comfort level with diversity? And I think that we've gotten to be down to a real extreme in terms of homogeneity. When you drive across the country and you look at the lack of diversity in landscapes, particularly human-managed landscapes, it shows the disease that we have. And it really is largely in our thought processes. And do we feel more comfortable in a native prairie or a forest or in a mowed lawn with introduced European grass species, and usually one or two? So that's, I don't know if that answers your question, but I think that we're centrally in an issue around our relationship to diversity.
So, actually, it's kind of, yeah, we are, because, I mean, you know, coming from a background as in the health, integrative health movement, and as a journalist for that movement and all of that, you know, one of the things that we know is that, you know, pharmaceutical science, which is, you know, a highly regarded form of science in our culture, you know, will target a single action, you know, on a singular molecular pathway of some kind in order to interrupt or intervene or change or deter some health, you know, some mechanism that is potentially contributing to an unhealthy effect. And so, you know, the drive of our industrial civilization and its science has been to go more and more and more toward, you know, the one true pill that will end our problems or something like this. Whereas we know from, for example, Chinese medicine, you know, they use multiple ingredients and there can be actual, you know, kind of health remedies where that some of them contain some similar ingredients and some different ingredients, and you know, and they are, they kind of help in different ways because the ingredients interact together, and you're frequently reporting on the toxicity side. You know, we study an individual thing that's harmful or one thing that's off, or what you're talking about, which is one product alone. You know, what we call a product. You know, that is taken from a natural. You know, from the earth, and not really looking at what the range of impacts are on the downside, and then on the upside, what the synergies are, you know, of using, you know, kind of cultivating a forest in a way that, and see, I'm even still using these terms like using, cultivating a forest in a way where multiple systems within it are functioning interactively in a way that's connected, supports them all, and offers greater gifts for, you know, for other purposes or, you know, and needs. So that's such a different way of seeing, you know, like how do we learn to see that way? What experiences have you had in your long life on this quest? Of, you know, to understand this, that we're really kind of like wake-up call moments where you were like, oh, my God, you know, suddenly I'm seeing or experiencing something in a whole different way in terms of seeing the diversity, seeing the interconnectivity. Because I think we can hear these terms, but we're starved, civilized people are starved for the experience of them, the lived experience of them, and that's actually something, you know, that has been a kind of a driving motivation for you, and, you know, along with playing a sustaining and protective role toward Earth, you know, in your life work. So, I mean, do you recall any kind of aha moments? I'm sure there must have been many, but.
Yeah, well, I'll get to that in maybe a moment. You touched on a number of things here. I think there are some reasons, some good reasons why science has gravitated toward reductionism. However, we've kind of got caught in our own trap in a way. It gets very difficult to measure the tremendous complexity within natural systems that are synergized to the level that they are. And when you're setting up experiments to prove that, you know, one compound is going to have a certain repeatable effect, it tends toward that reducing a plant with 300 different synergizing compounds in an herbal medicine to a pharmaceutical. There's a few things in there like, you know, patenting and you know, gaining control over the cash flow. But beyond that, there's also, you know, some scientific limitations on really being able to repeatedly prove the kinds of lessons that I think we need to learn. So there's that, and the other piece that I think is very large is a slow gravitation toward less and less physical work. And because people want to get away from hard physical labor, and that's been going on for quite some time, it moves it towards this industrialized model where the production is happening mass scale somewhere far away usually, and then, you know, there's some kind of very specific job that each person has that's not very integrated. It is more single function. And I think that's a huge piece of this. Now, The third part of your observation is what is it that, what kind of experiences that did I have that moved me toward this other way of thinking? And I think it was, I could talk about a lot of different things, but to a large degree, it was just largely exposure to wild natural systems. I was studying bird calls and animal tracks and identifying trees in winter and all of the mushrooms and wildflowers, and was just very hungrily learning that. And the way to do that for me was to move into that system, to be immersed in it 24 hours a day. And so I moved into the forest on the edge of what's now my gardens and so forth in a beautiful valley in southern Ohio. And I think it was really a collective set of observations that basically come into you through sort of osmosis. And it's really communication, it's feedback. I mean, when you start looking at disease, it's largely a lack of communication between cells, between systems in the body. If you look at the role of a lot of the compounds, neurotransmitters and messenger molecules, it's really a lot about communication. And when communication gets cut off, that's where you tend to start seeing disease. And I think in the larger sense that we've cut ourselves off from the natural world by building pretty artificial environments or habitats that are not connected. They're boxes, and people move around, go from one box to another, one with wheels to another one that doesn't, and generally the feedback from our relations, however you want to put that, all these other 50 million species that we share the planet with, we don't have a lot of interaction with. And I think it's a lot of it has to do with interaction. Now, having said that, when I trace my own experiences back to what definitely look like key moments, there tended to be a dissolution of my previously conditioned sense of who I was and the boundaries between my more temporary ego type of identity that you learn in school began to melt away, and a realization that the boundaries are not very clear. And as those boundaries really started to dissolve and started to see things more in a biocentric way rather than an egocentric or anthropocentric way, I think this thinking becomes common sense. And you could look all over the world in places where they didn't have access to subsidies, petroleum and, like I mentioned before, cheap labor and so forth. And what you find is that there's an inevitability of developing a much higher sense of ethnobotany, of what plants can get what done and how to use them, and a tremendous complexity of interactions within that environment and a cultivation of it. So one of the things that I've been looking back at is, like, how does this happen, and to be highly motivated and to experience the kinds of things that wake up our healthiest, largest sense of who we are. And for me, it was really at a very early age of experiencing a curiosity about the natural world and experiencing pretty quickly the beauty in nature. And through observation and through some sheer luck of having parents that pointed me in the right direction within a kind of an aesthetic eye. My mother is an artist and kind of an analytic aspect of my father being a scientist. And so they gave me some good tools to go into that curiosity and that beauty in nature, and pretty quickly developed a sense of wonder, kind of an infused mind and heart that led to gratitude, reverence, compassion, and eventually stewardship. And I think that whether we come at this from a scientific or a spiritual perspective, perspective, it's really all pointing to an interconnected system and our relationship to that system. And I think we have a deep, hardwired need to feel like we are not causing harm. And I think that it takes a lot of observation to understand which options create not only the least harm, but are directly displacing suffering. And I had an experience where, you know, one of these experiences that I mentioned, and when I came home, one of the residuals that I had from that was that that was really a profound, amazing experience, and I'm kind of a different person now, but the subconscious take-home message was that that was really amazing and beautiful and incredible, and it was that way because they don't let me or other people that I'm related to live in that place, that somehow these inspiring natural, you know, systems that we enter into and have these experiences, we go home and we practice a way of life that really takes those systems apart methodically.
Mm-hmm.
It became really kind of critical for me to find very specific ways to reverse that trend. And I think that I really think that evolutionarily we've come to a point where we kind of needed to, the clever monkey needed to get to the point of maybe hitting bottom from a petroleum addiction or, you know, a number of other ways we could talk about it. But I think we've hit a point where it's become really important for us to know that that the world can be a healthy place because we're here, not because we're not, you know, we're kept out. And so, you know, this is where I think we get into some very tangible landscape-level techniques that increase the capacity of life support of any given place. And so I really think that's where we are. I think it's haunting us and literally... when you know, I recently was, I think the talk you came to, I was looking at this huge spike of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere that is now making it very challenging to have stability. And when you look at that spike that goes for, you could look at 800,000 years and a whole series of ice ages, and the CO2 level really never got above 300 parts per million, and now we're well over 400. What we know for sure about that is that agriculture, which is an existential thing now, there's not enough wild food to just harvest like, you know, we did in our earlier evolutionary stages. And so we're reliant on some type of agriculture, and agriculture has never existed within a climate anything remotely like what we're in now. And so we need to design systems that have food security, energy security, water security, health, and climatic mitigation all at the same time. And luckily, I think that, you know, there's a way to do that. So, I mean, it's a tall order.
Let me just intervene and ask a question.
Yeah.
Is it a kind of big picture way, you know, like change the food system, or people in farming or rural regions, you know, can throughout the world can and should be doing that, and we should be supporting that? Or is there also a sort of little picture way in which, I don't know, anyone with access to, you know, a certain number of square feet of earth could also do? I mean, how many, you know, what level, you know, what about, And of course, I'm thinking of urban farming as well, you know, speaking to you today from New York City and everything, like what levels, because I think there's a lot of confusion about the levels at which we intervene. You know, on the one hand, people are like, well, I recycle, you know, but meanwhile, the fossil fuel industry is building pipelines across the country or whatever. In other words, what levels of intervention are, you know, going to be the key leverage points and the most important or accessible and or accessible?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think that depends on every individual's circumstances. And, I mean, it could be as simple as planting some herbs in a pot that flower on your, you know, on your porch that pollinators that are coming through are utilizing. I mean, it really all comes down to habitat, and I think the urban landscape is a bit challenging, but there's a lot to work with there, particularly when you start looking at how to work within community gardens and in, you know, what you have in an urban environment is a lot more social capital than what we might call natural capital. And I think there's a way to really utilize that, because when you go not very far out of the city, you get to the point where you have a lot more natural capital and a lot less social capital, and there's ways to build relationships between those two zones where a lot of the raw materials can be worked with in a cottage industry type of way with all that social capital. Anyway, that's a long conversation, but I'd say that each person has different amount of land, time, resources to work with, and when you look at that, then you can answer the question that you're asking. The beauty of it is that it can be at any level, and when you, in my opinion, when you create quality at any scale, it's revolutionary, and it will start catching on. People taste it. When people experience the quality in whatever format that's in, it's going to change people, because I think that one of the things that that people are responding to now is being very tired of low quality, mass produced, whatever it is. And so there's a lot of movements in the younger population of beginning to make their own things, and the excitement around that and the empowerment in it is a very good thing. And I think a lot of this is, you could reduce it down to that we've become divorced from our own lives. We don't have a lot of involvement in the production or the management of almost anything anymore. It's all outsourced. And I think that that's a problem for the way we feel about ourselves. We can kid ourselves all day long about it. But what I've seen in people in running curriculums of people through different experiential ways of learning, that people light up like light bulbs when they get connected to the source of things. And so the first step is, I think, get connected to the source of where things are coming from. And initially, it's not going to look pretty generally, but then as you work toward a higher level of quality, it feels better and better. And so I'm trying to keep people here, but because there's a million examples we could go into, particularly when you get access to more of a landscape, because I think most of the solutions that we would get into over most of the planet is all about landscapes. And I know our economy tells us, very differently, that nobody is going to get ahead by being a farmer, because you're going to be struggling with the economics, and you're probably not going to have health care and this, that, and the other. And having gone through a whole series of phases with that, of going from farmers markets and selling small amounts of vegetables locally to more contract growing of larger amounts to baby food companies, and then growing seeds and other things, that the economics is pretty rough. It's a fairly a part of our economy. And it takes a while to basically build your local economic system. My emphasis for economics is not so much on making money. I mean, that's always a part of it. But the primary emphasis is on looking at what you're going to use money for and produce as much of that as possible. And then look at the parts you look at the parts that you can't produce, and that's where you're going to need money. But the whole idea of just making money, which is a currency that is really divorced from natural capital, is really a fairly flawed way of looking at things, in my opinion. And so it's taken me 40 years or so, but to slowly put together systems that provide all of my electricity, my water, my hot water, my food, and many different categories, medicinal plants in the forest and mushrooms all around, beehives, maple syrup. Those things trickle in small amounts, sometimes larger amounts through the year, and if you know how to store them, then this becomes a really critical piece, because I think we live in a society that's a globalized, industrialized system that delivers our life to us daily with diesel vehicles, with large amounts of travel in each piece of that puzzle, a lot of packaging energy, and the costs are too high with this many people playing this game for the landscapes to sustain that. And so, mm-hmm. you know, bringing it down to a local level has a lot of reasons why that makes sense. You know, from a holistic perspective, it sure looks to me that concentration of power equals violence. And to take all the eggs out of one basket, you're avoiding a lot of broken eggs, which is kind of the point. So we've been kind of led down this pathway, but at the same time, we've selected it because of less work, less hardship. And we've traded that work. I don't know why we're so afraid of it, but people do move rapidly away from it. I guess it's been associated with, you know, groups of people that have been oppressed. And and so, you know, I'm not blaming it all on some external forces. I think that people have kind of gone along with this. Any time you get something that's convenient, you just kind of quickly go for that shiny object, and over time it's taken us to a place of really as far from being integrated as you can get. Average person is about as connected to the landscape around them, the bioregion, the watershed, the conditions of the ecosystems that they live in. It's just really not a part of the thinking or the daily practice. And so it's going to look like work up front, you know, to look at the transition. And you know, Thomas Edison had said that opportunity is missed by most people because it's dressed in overalls and looks like work. And I've found that to be kind of humorous, but also very instructive. And I think, and at some point, it might have been about laziness. I think it's something different now. I think that the quality of our nutrition and the food and what's happening at the mitochondrial level in the body is making it more and more hard to muster the extra energy to retool, to change over all of our habits, and to, you know, roll up our sleeves and get into personally all of the aspects that we need to derive from the earth for our existence. And hidden within that perceived negativity of hard work is this amazing, empowered, wondrous nature of holding something that you have had years of interaction with. And have this happened for me one year, living in a little cabin back in the woods near where I live now, in the middle of a blizzard, where there was, you know, feet of snow on the ground, and I was living in a little shack with a wood stove. And I pulled a quart of peaches off the shelf that I had planted from little peach trees and watched them grow. And then that first taste of peaches in the winter, looking out my window from a little warm cabin, there was something happening in that bite of peaches where I was reliving all of the summer thunderstorms and rainbows and watching those little trees grow all the way up to and having peaches and then canning them and pulling them out in that moment. There was a value in that experience that can't be bought, that no amount of money, you could be the richest person in the world and you couldn't buy one taste of those peaches. There's something that we lost in our own relationship to our lives, and it's a lot to backtrack from, you know, from this, you know, point in history where we've been so far removed, that to think about becoming all the way back connected into it is a lot to think about it. But I don't think you really have to do that. I think small things that you get involved in, and you can get that feel of quality. I would say that what we're talking about here is real quality. and it's not somebody else that. I mean, I enjoy a lot of things from around the world where people have put that kind of energy into things that I enjoy. It's not that you have to do everything yourself, but I think there's a lot of gray area in between where we are and what we could be doing. And when you do that, mm-hmm. you do grow something locally, you're taking out that 1,300 miles of travel that's in that packaged product that you would have used otherwise, and the packaging and so forth. And these things really add up collectively, you know, as a group of people or a species. These small acts are much more powerful than we've been led to believe.
Mm. You know, it's interesting because as somebody who does work that is mental and computer-based, you know, ideas, communication, writing, you know, and interacting with people in those ways, that's not very sensorially based, you know, and I've long been aware of that, obviously. So, you know, for me, for example, you know, I'm always seeking ways to balance it, either through practicing movement forms, which has been my lifelong, most long-standing process throughout my life. Or recently, you know, honestly, I took up sewing and doing more cooking and cooking for groups and stuff like that because I think that we, you know, when we're addicted to our phones and we're in this, you know, kind of virtual mental world all the time, we actually lose, a further step is connection to nature through planting and the things that you're mentioning, but even an earlier step is a sensorial, tactile, you know, sensory connection to sensory process, whatever that might be. You know, and the way it shows up most frequently in a home might be, you know, cleaning, for example, the home, or cooking in the home or whatever. So even some of these very basic home-sustaining skills, you know, have always been sort of denigrated, but they're all sensory skills that if kind of re-embraced and developed and, you know, actually lead, you know, kind of, in my experience, can lead from the home back outside the home into the environment. So it's almost like a process of, you know, rediscovery step by step that actually is incredibly gratifying. So that's just my interjection there. But, you know, if people wanted to learn or study this further and kind of get a sense of where to begin, you know, where could they go?
Yeah, there's so many different pieces to draw from. I think it depends on where a person is at. You know, if I could talk to individuals, I could help be much more specific on that. When you try to say what's a one-size-fits-all mm-hmm. place to start. I mean, the introduction to permaculture is a very good point to look at in terms of holistic thinking and design as it applies to human cultural habitat. Jerry Brunetti's book, Farm as Ecosystem, I think is very good. I mean, there's so many other specific points. We'd have to develop a reading list, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I mean, a lot of this, I agree with you that, you know, home economics, there's a way to look at home economics that is extremely powerful and empowering. And it doesn't have to be about, you know, we've been talking about food and agriculture a lot. It's really about everything that happens at a cultural home level, and that there's a lot there. One of the things I've been looking at a lot is the concentration, you know, looking at how unnecessarily vulnerable we are to a system of life support delivery that comes in every day. That requires a vast network and very energy-intensive system to produce. I guess what I'm getting at here is if you do have a lot of production locally in the home economic systems over, say, a region, and people have looked at how to store the abundance, because what happens is the things come along in big spurts, and that you have to know how to store them to get through the winter, to get through to the next crop or whatever. And I do this with my batteries on a sunny day. Like, you know, 3/4 of the world's food supply is even today, after all of the monopolization and the control of the seed and the pushing of the chemicals and so forth and so on. 3/4 of the world's food supply is coming from small, diversified land holdings. And so this highly industrialized model is only producing 25% of the food, and it's doing a terrible job in terms of the toxics and the low nutrition and the waste that is involved in all of that. So a lot of times I think, our media is having a very negative effect by disappearing all the functional reference points. And I think that, you know, we keep, you know, everybody's all concerned, and there's a lot of anxiety about the state of our society, civilization, but we keep looking at the wrong end of it. We keep looking at the dysfunctional part, and it's disempowering. Whereas the reality of it is that nature is working quite well, and it works a lot better when you take your hand off its throat and stop squeezing. And so dysfunction requires a certain amount of maintenance. And I think that we need to just kind of look at our role in whether we're maintaining dysfunction or we're regenerating the important aspects of what we're going to be leaving behind. At the end of the day, when petroleum products are either too expensive or it's basically going to be too expensive before it's completely gone, then you'll find that you need to cooperate with people around you. And it's not just about linking up with people online of like mind that are far away. It's really about getting organized within your actual watershed, within the actual biological region you live in. Our present condition is centrally involved with our relationship to carbon. And it could be a whole series of shows probably on what I mean by that. But you know, for example, I think there could be some energy breakthroughs where electricity is very abundant. But does that just keep people in front of their two-dimensional screens and basically enable a disconnection that is already very deep? Whereas the carbon story, which is pretty much, I started to mention that spike of CO2 on the graph that goes back, you know, millions of years, really, that we have this huge spike that's higher than it's ever been since we've been the type of primates that we are. And what is that? You know, when I started to look at that and think about what it really is that's the carbon that used to be in our soils, all, you know, the millions of soil organisms that have been eroded and killed off by chemicals and, you know, cultivation and compaction and so forth. But it's also the tremendous ancient forests and the great whales and if you go back and you look at what the early European explorers were writing in their journals about what they saw not only in North America but all over the world, this was a phenomenally abundant planet. And those life forms were carbon life forms, and they've been largely eradicated. You know, the passenger pigeons, and you can go on and on and on about what you see in those records that are very much been reduced, radically reduced, and that's where they are. They're up in the atmosphere, and they're kind of haunting the possibility of having stable climates, the ones that we've gotten used to. The last 10,000 years has been phenomenally gentle compared to, the last 100,000. And so now we have to figure out how to adapt an agricultural system to an environment that it's never seen before. And so there's a whole conversation about that, and I wish we had more time because there's some really sweet spots of how to achieve many goals simultaneously. And I think that's what we've been sort of heading towards here. But in terms of actual practice, what does it look like? How to transform what we have now, what we see as forests and agricultural landscapes, how do we transform that into something that can sail through far far larger extremes than the ones that are presently out there? And there are resources that we're not tapping, and there are ways of getting those resources that enhance the systems that we derive them from. We're either building capacity or we're staying incredibly dependent upon temporary conditions and conditions that are generating footprints that are completely out of phase with what we want in the world.
Thank you so much, Mark D. Cohen, permaculturalist and longtime regenerative agriculturist today, of agriculture. And thank you for taking a look at our impact on the world. We can do growing healthy food to improve our climate. Back with you next week on Connect the Dots with more programming, and also look for future programs with Mark D. Cohen, as this is an ongoing theme of Connect the Dots. Thank you, listeners, for being with us, and we'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Stand tall, keep marching forward, and be confident that we can regain our world working together with all our relations.
Well, who, where?